From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, and it's my pleasure to be sitting in for Tony today. We've got a number of high-profile topics on tap today, but I'm going to start off with Planned Parenthood. We're going to do a little fact-checking and address two topics. They've claimed recently that most late-term abortions are performed due to severe fetal abnormalities or serious risks to the woman's health. Now, this is a claim not even supported by abortionists. So we're going to talk to Dr. Susan Berry about this. Planned Parenthood, with some partners, has also just recently launched a new YouTube channel with sex ed videos designed for children as young as, wait for it, 4 years. It's called Amaze Junior, and she'll stay with me so that we can talk about it. In our second segment, President Trump at the National Prayer Breakfast just yesterday cited the story of a Michigan couple who adopted 5 special needs children through a faith-based adoption agency. The ACLU is contending that the Catholic group should be compelled to place children with parents who do not share their worldviews, forcing them to violate their deeply held religious beliefs. Beckett Fund attorney Nick Reeve joins me to talk about that. At 32 past the hour, we'll feature some compelling audio from recent Senate Judiciary Committee meetings this week about whether there should be a religious test applied to judicial nominees. Democrat Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey interrogated one recent nominee about whether she thought homosexuality and behavior was inherently sinful, and 2 GOP senators pushed back. In our last segment, the surprising Supreme Court decision last night, 5-4, temporarily blocked a pro-life Louisiana law that required abortionists to have nearby hospital admitting privileges. Ken Klukowski of First Liberty Institute joins me in studio to talk about Chief Justice John Roberts siding with the 4 liberal justices in the majority on this case. For more information, follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins. As always, you can find podcasts of all of our broadcasts at TonyPerkins.com, where you can also go and search any information related to the individuals that we have on our show during the week. Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry again, Director of Partnerships here. And we're going to start out by fact-checking Planned Parenthood. Recently, in an effort to do a little damage control after some of the State of the Union commentary that President Trump made about late-term abortions and trying to stem the tide of disruptive commentary to Planned Parenthood's mission for very aggressive bills in New York and in Virginia permitting late-term abortions, Planned Parenthood President Leanna Wen caught to Twitter and made the remark that 90% of abortions occur before 21 weeks. This is a direct quote. As a doctor and public health expert, I can tell you that those occur later often result from a diagnosis of severe fetal abnormality or serious risk to a woman's health. Here to delve into that topic and another is Dr. Susan Berry. She has a doctorate in psychology and writes frequently about cultural, educational, and healthcare issues for Breitbart.com. Dr. Berry, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
How do you, Dr. Berry, respond to the claim by Planned Parenthood, by Dr. Leanna Wen, we know their new president, that most late-term abortions are due to severe fetal abnormalities or serious risk to the woman's health? Obviously saying what she said in a tweet directly after the State of the Union. Were you surprised by the fact that she had attributed the majority of abortions to earlier term first and second trimester procedures?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that it is true that most abortions occur earlier in pregnancy. However, the claim that most later-term abortions in the third trimester are due to fetal anomalies or severe risks to the mother's health, I mean, abortionists themselves over the years have been telling us that that is not true. Even in 1997, for example, Ron Fitzsimmons, who was the executive director of the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, in an interview with the Los Angeles Times, he said that it was true. The abortion rights folks know it, and the anti-abortion folks know it, and so probably does everyone else, that many abortions that occur in the third trimester are elective abortions. They're due to issues about financial problems, problems with the father of the child. Women, believe it or not, who do not even know that they're pregnant until the eighth or ninth month, and other issues as well, many having to do with finances. So these are all very elective reasons and nothing to do with fetal anomalies or severe risk of health to the mother. We even have another quote from assassinated abortionist George Tiller. He told the National Abortion Federation in 1995, you know, he said, we have some experience with late terminations. He said that about 10,000 patients between 24 and 36 weeks and something like 800 fetal anomalies between 26 and 36 weeks in the past 5 years. That's the abortions that he's done in that later term of the pregnancy. But he says that, you know, that equates to more than 8% of his late term patients who aborted because their babies were diagnosed with a health condition. So all the other third trimester abortions were not because of those reasons, were for more elective reasons. And we have reports also of people who have worked for Planned Parenthood in the past. As you know, Abby Johnson, yes, who is a former Planned Parenthood manager and a pro-life activist, she also has interviewed some people from her group who have left the abortion industry, and they've also attested to the fact that many third trimester abortions are done electively, if not most of them. Some of them say that overwhelmingly the procedures are not for fetal anomalies. And then we have to remember that there, in terms of the health risk to the mother, that's a very vague area. And that needs to be really looked at, because we know that in the Supreme Court follow-up cases, we know, in fact, that that the risk to the mother is a very wide category. Health can include psychological health. It can include, issues about the family. It's a very wide and vague category that really has not always something to do with the physical health of the mother or as if the mother's life is in danger. And then the other area that I find is very interesting is there are people in pro-abortion rights group that are talking about, well, it happens when the fetus is no longer viable or in demise. But that implies that the fetus is already deceased. And that is not abortion at that point. I mean, if a fetus is already deceased and it's been determined that, then we're not talking really about abortion. So there's a lot of purposefully vague comments made about this whole area. And I think that we do have a lot of information from abortionists themselves who tell us that is not the case. Most recently, the Guttmacher Institute, for example, in 2014, released a study and found that women who were seeking both first trimester and late-term abortions provided the same reasons for delaying their abortions, you know, not knowing about the pregnancy, financial issues, disagreeing with the man involved in the pregnancy. And the study found that most women seeking later terminations are not doing so for reasons of fetal anomaly or life endangerment. So I think that there's enough information from the abortion industry itself that shows us that these claims that these third trimester abortions are done for these extreme situations, but that's really not accurate.
Now, it's interesting because she timed this appropriately after the State of the Union, but we understand that there is sort of a groundswell of commentary and criticism based on both pending and past legislation everywhere from Vermont to New Mexico to New York to Virginia. Do you think that the criticism of these late...
I'm having a hard time hearing you, Sarah.
Do you think that the criticism of some of these late-term abortion bills that are pending nationwide from Vermont down to New Mexico, is it possible that we've overblown the crisis of these extremely aggressive pro-abortion bills? Or, based on what your research has demonstrated, are we sort of...
I'm really having a hard time hearing you.
Are we paying appropriate attention to the fact that there is a crisis underfoot, a crisis of third trimester abortions that, in permitting through state legislation, we've actually made them more accessible and more reasonable to get in the first place?
Well, I'm having a hard time hearing your question, but I think that there is, you know, a real push to try to make these more acceptable. Again, you know, if we just even think about how the abortion issue has progressed over the years, you know, at first it was just, you know, we want abortions to be safe, legal, and rare. But now it seems like we're pushing even to the throes of infanticide, you know, where that we're having these issues about, you know, babies that are born after abortion, you know, quote unquote, accidentally born alive after abortion. And then if we get back to Governor Northam of Virginia, his comments about, you know, the baby would be kept, you know, comfortable until the parents and the doctor or the mother and the doctor could decide what to do. I mean, that is such a scary and frightening image. And, you know, I think that's where people are really alarmed about where this is going, that there's people are actually making decisions about whether to keep a baby alive or not. And with these extreme bills, and now in New York, it's a law. We have other states that are coming up with very extreme legislation. I think this is really bringing the whole issue of abortion. It's stirring it all up again, but we're seeing the extremity of it and where it is going. And where we're talking about that, you know, women have the right to make this decision to even, you know, end the life of a baby that they maybe intended to abort, but now is suddenly born alive, and that they still can exert that control. And I think that that's really alarming people.
Dr. Barry, thanks so much for joining me today on Washington Watch. I'm sure it will not surprise our listeners that Planned Parenthood has not only launched a YouTube channel for children, but also an app, both designed to get them to ask questions about sex. Joining me next, we are going to be talking about what a faith-based adoption agency in Michigan had to contend with when placing foster children with the appropriate families.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy that inspire us from childhood, such as unicorns and the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being, from the Loch Ness Monster to big tax refunds. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. Since 1973, these abortion myths have grown a substantial foothold in developing a climate of fear, misinformation, and a culture of death in the United States. In FRC's new analysis, learn whether most Americans support abortion on demand, and if a fetus does in fact feel pain in the womb. Join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Remember to check out our podcast at tonyperkins.com in case you've missed any portion of the show and for further information on our guest today. Well, as guests of the White House, Melissa and Chad Buck, who are parents to five children with special needs, were recognized yesterday morning by President Trump at the 67th Annual National Prayer Breakfast here in Washington, D.C. They have adopted their kids through St. Vincent Catholic Charities, and that's a faith-based adoption agency partnering with the state of Michigan to place foster children at appropriate homes. St. Vincent, as a faith-based agency, is motivated by their religious faith, is very successful at finding homes, and has worked exclusively to be one of the most productive foster agencies and adoption agencies, placing more in the state of Michigan than any other adoption agency. But because no good deed these days goes unpunished, the ACLU is now suing the state of Michigan, trying to end the important partnership, and families like the Bucks are joining the suit to fight back. Let's listen to what President Trump had to say when he affirmed the fight for faith-based adoption agencies.
As president, I will always cherish, honor, and protect the believers who uplift our communities and sustain our nation to ensure that people of faith can always contribute to our society. My administration has taken historic action to protect religious liberty. We will always protect our country's long and proud tradition of faith-based adoption. My administration is working to ensure that faith-based adoption agencies are able to help vulnerable children find their forever families while following their deeply held beliefs.
My next guest is attorney Nick Reeve of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, which believes that a faith-based adoption agency should be allowed to place children with like-minded parents and freely exercise their religious beliefs. Nick, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Nick, let's talk a little bit about the condition of these five sweet children who were eventually placed with Melissa and Chad Buck. What was the environment that these children were living in?
That's a good question. They were coming out of very difficult family situations. Three of the siblings that the Buck family adopted were all from the same birth family, and that was really one of the reasons that motivated the Bucks to adopt them, because they thought, these kids have lost so much in their lives. One thing we can give them is to keep them together. So, you know, the Bucks weren't initially looking to adopt a set of three siblings, but they felt called to do that.
Now, my understanding is that every year hundreds of children age out of the foster system, and that means that at age 18, they're on their own. So you have sort of this burgeoning necessity for organizations like St. Vincent's to figure out where these children are best suited to live before they become older. And you have this compelling story of Melissa and Chad Buck, who went out of their way not only to take siblings, but to take these children who all have special needs. And I speak from experience on this, as I have a child with special needs. This is really an incredible labor of love. So the ACLU's lawsuit is actually threatening to shutter St. Vincent's exclusively. So upon what ground is First Liberty, is Beckett Fund, are organizations like ours, what argument do we make when we are dealing with faith-based agencies and their right to exercise their beliefs?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. And I think you highlighted some of the answers there as well. I think the most important thing is, you know, there are 13,000 children in foster care in Michigan today, and the state has said they're looking for 300 new adoptive homes right now. And I think it's important to realize that Michigan's a large state, and we need all hands on deck to help these children. So we need to be encouraging more agencies, more parents, and more families to get involved in foster care and adoption, and not trying to close down, like you said, some of the most effective agencies in the state because you might disagree with their religious beliefs.
Can you tell me a little bit about the couple that was bringing the suit against the state of Michigan and whether or not they were actually denied by St. Vincent's in terms of seeking out an adoptive agency with a foster child? We, of course, as lawyers, always talk about standing, whether anyone has a claim in the first case, whether there's a justiciable issue. And we're dealing right here with a family who you would think had been denied, had been directly affected by St. Vincent's exercising its religious freedom. Was that actually the case?
No. So that's a good question. So under Michigan law, what actually happens is if a couple approaches St. Vincent or any other agency with sincerely held religious beliefs, and that agency determines they're not able to help that family, what they're required to do by state law is refer them to one of the other nearby agencies that would be able to help the family. So, for example, the state of Michigan contracts with over 60 different adoption providers and has contracts with 90 different agencies to provide foster care. So there really isn't any shortage of agencies to contact. And the other option is to go directly to the state because they often will provide these services. They directly provide foster care certifications, and they oversee foster care placements too.
So they had opportunity to adopt through other locations, through other providers. So this looks to be a little bit of a petty lawsuit. Nick Reeve with Beckett Fund has been my excellent guest today. We will be following the lawsuit closely. This is obviously an issue that has a great deal of import for those of us who are in the sphere and who have ever utilized a faith-based organization for any service or product. Thanks for the good work that you do. This is Washington Watch. We'll be right back after this.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy that inspire us from childhood, such as unicorns and the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being, from the Loch Ness Monster to big tax refunds. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. Since 1973, these abortion myths have grown a substantial foothold in developing a climate of fear, misinformation, and a culture of death in the United States. In FRC's new analysis, learn whether most Americans support abortion on demand, and if a fetus does in fact feel pain in the womb. Join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
To Washington Watch, this is Sarah Perry, FRC's Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Well, it seems that Democrats continue to have a religion problem. Democrat Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, who has presidential aspirations, as we now know, had the audacity to question yet another judicial nominee. Naomi Rao, about whether she is a Catholic, thought that homosexual behavior was a sin. Rao is Trump's nominee to replace Brett Kavanaugh on the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is largely considered the second most important circuit court in the country. So I'll feature that audio. And to their credit, Republican Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Mike Lee of Utah, both on the Judiciary Committee, pushed back strenuously, asserting it was a violation of Article 6 of the Constitution, which says explicitly there shall be no religious test for any public office. And I've got their audio as well. Let's listen to what Cory Booker questioned Naomi Rao with in this first clip.
In a 2008 article, you criticized the Supreme Court's landmark decision in Lawrence v. Texas, which invalidated the state laws that criminalize same-sex relationships. You said that the court's decision, quote, eschews older traditions in favor of an emerging awareness of the meaning of and the scope of liberty. What, in your view, should the Supreme Court have been in the business of upholding older traditions, as you said, of laws that criminalize same-sex relationships?
Well, Senator, those were some comments made in the course of an article about dignity and constitutional law. And of course, Lawrence is a precedent in the Supreme Court, which I would faithfully follow if I were confirmed.
Are gay relationships, in your opinion, immoral?
Senator, I'm not sure, you know, the relevance of that to, you know, I mean,
I think relevant your opinion. If you think African-American relationships are immoral, do you think gay relationships are immoral? Do you personally believe that gay relationships?
No, I do not.
You do not believe that?
No.
Do you believe they're a sin?
Senator, you know, my personal views on any of these subjects are things I would put to one side and I would faithfully follow.
So you're not willing to say here that whether you believe it is sinful for married. You're not willing to comment on that?
You know, Senator, no.
Well, excuse me?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear your response.
My response is that these personal views are ones that I would put to one side, whatever my personal views are on this subject.
Well, listen to that incredibly awkward exchange and realize what she's being asked goes specifically to the nature of her religious beliefs and how they possibly inform her jurisprudential leanings. But it gets better because Ted Cruz of Texas blasted Democrats for creating what he felt was a theological court of inquisition. Let's listen to what he said.
Senate Judiciary Committee should not be a theater for mischaracterizing or twisting nominees' records or views, nor should it be an avenue for persecution. We've seen a growing pattern among Senate Democrats of hostility to religious faith. I have to say I was deeply troubled a few minutes ago to hear questioning of a nominee asking your personal views on what is sinful. In my view, that has no business in this committee. Article 6 of the Constitution says there should be no religious test for any public office. We have also seen Senate Democrats attack what they've characterized as religious dogma. We've seen Senate Democrats attack nominees for their own personal views on salvation. I don't believe this is a theological court of inquisition.
Well, just yesterday, Republican Utah Senator Mike Lee condemned Senate Judiciary Democrats for questioning judicial nominees' religious beliefs, in agreement with what Senator Ted Cruz had said, and specifically called out Senator from Hawaii, Mazie Hirono. Let's listen in.
The problem with asking a nominee about the particulars of his or her religious beliefs is that those questions inevitably expose those beliefs as somehow a qualifier or a disqualifier for public office. That is flatly inconsistent with at least the spirit, if not also the letter, of at least two provisions of the Constitution. I cannot fathom why this would ever make sense to do. There was a time in this country when people might have been asked in a job interview context or in the context of a hearing like those we hold here, whether someone believed in God, whether they were Christian. When they might have been asked those, it was not for a good reason, because there is never a good reason in a public setting to ask that question, save perhaps if you just want to make sure that that person's religious beliefs do not require that person to betray the judicial oath. Beyond that, I can't fathom a circumstance in which that would be appropriate. So I would ask Senator Hirono, in what circumstance, in what way, shape, or form is asking Naomi Rao whether she believes particular conduct to be sinful an appropriate question to be asked in this committee, ever?
These probing questions, if you were to list all of the questions that we ask, they have to do with whether or not these nominees very strongly held religious views, as well as any other views that may not enable them to be objective as judges in lifetime positions. I think that's a legitimate area of inquiry. And it is not that we all ask, do you think such and such is a sin, et cetera, et cetera. Although,
well, that was asked that this week. This week it was asked. I'm not making this up.
Obviously, there seems to be a bit of forgetfulness on the part of Senator Mazie Hirono when she realized that Senator Booker had asked the exact question that she said they would not ask. In fact, writing rather presciently at the National Review in their bench memo column, Carrie Severino back in 2017 led the charge, arguing that indeed Senate Democrats were prohibitively imposing a religious test. That was with Amy Comey Barrett. And that began a tirade of five more judicial nominees to experience the same thing. Well, you are again listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here. I will now be talking next about a surprising 5-4 Supreme Court decision which blocked a Louisiana pro-life law requiring abortionists to have hospital admitting privileges. Ken Klukowski of First Liberty Institute joins me, and I will take your calls if I am able. Remember that you can always dial the Senate and House hotlines, 202-224-3121, 202-225-3121. We'll be right back.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy, from unicorns to the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. In FRC's analysis, 10 Myths on Abortion, join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to our other free resources, go to frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry, and it's my pleasure to sit in for Tony today. Well, Chief Justice John Roberts joined the Supreme Court's liberal wing in what some people viewed as a surprise, temporarily blocking a Louisiana pro-life law requiring abortionists to have hospital admitting privileges. Common sense. Ken Klukowski is my guest here. He's an attorney with First Liberty Institute. Welcome, Ken.
Sarah, thanks for having me.
All right, let's talk a little bit about this decision, because much has been made of the fact that this appears on the surface to be a win for abortion rights. Do you agree or disagree?
I disagree, but I would say we're in a wait and see mode. I mean, to unpack this for a second, it is in 2016, the Supreme Court considered a law similar to this Louisiana law. That was a Texas law that, like Louisiana, was requiring doctors who were performing abortion to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. But it was also requiring that abortion clinics have equipment and sanitation standards like an urgent care, which to me is just common sense. What kind of woman wants to go to a dirty place to have anything surgical done? But nonetheless, by a 5-4 decision with Justice Kennedy as the swing vote, the Supreme Court said that nonetheless that imposed an undue burden on abortion. This is the first ruling, even temporarily, that we've gotten of any sort since Justice Kavanaugh took Justice Kennedy's seat. And so everyone was looking to see what would happen here. It's important, though, that people understand this was not a ruling on the merits, what happened last night. A Louisiana trial judge said, I think this law looks so much like the Texas law that I'm going to have to strike it down. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit reversed in a 2-1 decision, explaining how the laws were different and thus why this was not an undue burden on abortion. Going up to the Supremes, the abortionist lawyers were saying, if you let this ruling go into effect before we even have time to file an appeal to you at the Supreme Court, by the time you decide it, every abortion clinic except one in the entire state will go out of business and will never be able to come back. Mm. So they said there will be irreparable harm to us unless you put this all on ice, at least until we file our petition and you decide whether you even want to take the case, because otherwise it'll just be too late. That was the 5-4 decision here, that Roberts joined the liberal wing just in terms of keeping this law from going into effect while the court reads the papers to decide whether to take up this case.
So originally the Texas law in 2016, Kennedy was the swing vote, and now we have a totally different composition. We have Kavanaugh writing the dissent in this case. Yes. Are you surprised that a justice who is a purported conservative sided with the liberal majority in this case on the issue of a procedural matter like this? Do you distinguish where Roberts comes down procedurally from where he might come down on the merits in this case?
I definitely distinguish it. And it can mean one of two things. There are four factors that the Supreme Court looks at when they decide whether to grant what's called a stay pending appeal. Two of those are irrelevant here. The two that matter, and what's normally the big one, is whether there is a substantial likelihood that the Supreme Court will vote to grant review, take the case up, and then once they do so, that they're going to reverse the lower court. Now, if that's what the Chief Justice was thinking when he voted for this stay, that would be a real problem, because that means he thinks this law is ultimately going to be struck down and he would have to be the fifth vote to do it. However, one of the other four factors is the one I just mentioned, irreparable harm. And that is where the parties say, court, you have to freeze the status quo right now. If you don't block this right now, this whole situation is going to burst into flames. In this case, they are saying this case will become moot. We'll all be out of business. We won't even be here by the time you could actually decide this case in the coming months. And so all they were asking for in that regard is time. So if he was voting to signal where he might go, that would be a huge concern. It'd be a disaster for the pro-life movement.
Sure.
If instead he was just freezing the status quo, then it's not at all a problem, except, of course, for all the abortions that will be performed, you know, over the next few months. I will say this. Chief Justice Roberts has never voted the wrong way on the merits of any abortion case since he joined the court 14 years ago. I cannot recall off the top of my head of his ever voting the wrong way on any social issue, religious liberty, which is what we focus on at First Liberty
Sure.
Institute, or any of the other social issues, speaking, of course, as a constitutional conservative here. So I would be quite surprised if this signals that this would be the first such bad news coming.
Understanding that the undue burden was the stated reason for trying to get the Fifth Circuit to sort of back off, right, and to get the Supreme Court to take up the case because these doctors, these clinics were apparently unduly burdened. What's the time frame that we're looking at to send the case back down to the Fifth Circuit to seek the appropriate certifications, to get the appropriate licenses? What are we looking at timeline-wise in terms of when this might go back up to the Supreme Court for a ruling on the merits?
The abortion lawyers have 90 days from the day that the Fifth Circuit declined to rehear the case.
Okay.
They have 90 days from then to file a petition for certiorari at the Supreme Court. That is the formal request for the justices to take the case. I'm trying to remember the date on the ruling. I think it was a couple weeks ago, perhaps, when the Fifth Circuit declined to do that. But I'd have to check and see. I apologize. But let's say in the next month or two, a cert petition will be filed. Now, mid-January was the cutoff for new cases this term. So all of this is being kicked to the fall now. So if a cert petition were filed in March, then I would expect a vote by May on whether to take the case. And if they're taking it in May, that means they'll be setting it for about November or December argument, with the decision coming down, I would say, late spring or by June of 2020.
All right. I'm going to expand the abortion question from the legal context, speaking lawyer to lawyer here. From the standpoint of whether or not Roe v. Wade is settled law, is considered precedent, understanding Chief Justice Roberts' commitment to stare decisis, what he says he will do based on settled law, we now are lacking Kennedy. So if the composition of the court changes, what's the likely outcome?
Well, that becomes the real question. It is, as I said, Chief Justice Roberts has never voted on the side of abortion. On the flip side, there are two things going on here. One is that of the nine justices, the Chief Justice is the biggest stickler when it comes to stare decisis. He is more focused on adhering to precedent. For him, he sets the bar higher than any of the others in terms of the bar you need to get over for him to overrule precedent. Mm-hmm. If he can distinguish this 2016 case that I referenced, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, if he can decide that this is a different case, then it's a no-brainer. I think
right.
he's definitely going to vote in the pro-life direction. If he thinks this cannot be distinguished, and I think the lawyers, Gene Scher, great pro-life lawyer, and the team out of the Louisiana Attorney General's office who argued this, I think they did a great job of explaining, as the judge did, Judge Smith, who wrote the majority opinion for the Fifth Circuit here, as to why these laws are different. But if the chief would not see it as different, then it becomes a question of, does this meet the extraordinary circumstances for overruling precedent? And if so, that's a second way that the not just the pro-life movement, but the state of Louisiana, the people of Louisiana who wanted this law for the sake of women's safety, of all things.
Sure.
It is to say, if why is this law here? If a doctor's performing an abortion and it's a botched abortion and the woman may die along with the unborn child, this is just saying you need to be a doctor who can accompany her to the hospital, a nearby hospital, and you have admitting privileges there. You can be part of the operating team. You're the person who knows the whole health history of
right.
this woman. You're the doctor who was involved. It is in her best interest that you are now involved in any emergency medical care that she is receiving. That's what this law was. It was a women's safety law. It was
sure.
a women's health care law. But that would be then the question before the Chief Justice. He dissented in that 2016 case. He voted with the others to say that that the Texas law is constitutional. And it's the pro-lifers can hope that he still holds. There's no reason to doubt that he still holds to that view.
So in the previous segment, we were playing some audio about this impermissible new trend dealing with the religious test, the unspoken in terms of its actual dictum, but implied very strongly for these judicial nominees that have come down the pike. And it really started with Amy Comey Barrett,
yes.
who had to suffer the slings and arrows of Dianne Feinstein's commentary that the dogma lived loudly within
her.
Yeah,
she sounded like Yoda.
What
kind of a human being speaks though?
Correct.
The dogma lives loudly. Yes. And it's like, are you okay, ma'am? I mean,
right. And that was sort of the beginning of this sort of cresting trend of, okay, well, Senate Dems, everything's on the line at this point. We know the Supreme Court hangs in the balance.
I just saw a bumper sticker that said, you know, Catholic and proud, and under it said, the dogma lives loudly
oh,
in me. So
wonderful.
So evidently people are now cashing in on that.
We now need that for evangelicals. We need
yes,
those for,
yes.
for those of the Jewish faith.
Yes.
I think in any public atmosphere, I think we do what we can to make light of a very difficult circumstance.
Yes.
But understanding that the composition of the Supreme Court hangs in the balance, and understanding that Naomi Rao was the most recent candidate to be sort of pinpointed by the very aspirational Cory Booker, who has such big plans for the presidency.
Yeah, and who wanted to ask her about her views on sin.
Right,
so, yeah,
exactly.
Right, exactly.
And it wasn't just Amy Barrett, and it wasn't just Naomi Rao, but it was three other district and circuit
yes.
court nominees who have sort of skated underneath the radar, but were questioned in written questions as well. We are seeing this sort of impermissible reliance on language that the Supreme Court or that the Constitution explicitly says
yep.
is not to be employed.
Correct.
So how do we put the brakes on a situation like that? Do we rely solely on the Republican composition of the Senate Judiciary Committee to trust that that kind of a situation won't ultimately result in the disqualification of perfectly suited jurists?
The cold reality is that there are some provisions in the U.S. Constitution, not many, but some, where judges aren't in charge of enforcing them. And in this case, when it says no religious test shall be employed to determine a person's fitness for federal office, that's in Article 6 of the Constitution, the religious test clause, there is no way to force the Senate in terms of how a senator is going to vote. They're actually covered under the speech or debate clause of the Constitution. They're shielded by legislative immunity. They can never be held legally accountable in a courtroom for how mm-hmm. they vote. they can only police themselves, and that is that they can discipline their own members and they can expel their own members with a two-thirds supermajority vote. This is one of those political realities where people get the government that they vote for. Mm. The only thing we can do is for people, and I say this, you know, we're in this 501c3 context here, but it's to inform voters so that voters hold their senators accountable to their oath of office, their oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and to bear true faith and allegiance to it. If a senator just brazenly, flagrantly violates their oath and says, I don't like your religious faith, and so I'm going to vote against you for that, the only remedy there is to educate the voters of that state so that they can decide if they want to choose another senator, whether they want to decide that they're going to hold their senators from their state accountable to uphold the Constitution that they swore to defend.
I would imagine that we're going to see a lot more of this. In fact, 44 federal appointees were just voted out of Senate committee, so we know that they are now heading to the open Senate floor vote and the confirmation hearings. And one of those was also a former intern at Alliance Defending Freedom, who you know so well has been tagged with the hate group label. And I would think that there will probably come into play more discussion about whether or not her religious beliefs and affiliating with a nonprofit public advocacy organization that takes on these religious liberty cases constitutes some kind of a violation of her character and her temperament and her inability to rule appropriately. So I think we're going to see more of this. Would you agree?
I am very saddened to say I think that is the case. The good news is I think that the American people showed in 2016 when we had for the first time ever with Hillary Clinton, for the first time, you had a nominee for a major party who didn't even give lip service, but who said flat out to an LGBT group that religious beliefs on this issue, not how you run your businesses in the marketplace, but those beliefs, those teachings, must be changed, and called people a basket of deplorables if they held these beliefs, et cetera. The American, for the other side, philosophically, not partisan, philosophically, for the other side, the mask is slipping. Mm. They're showing their utter hostility towards religious faith that they disagree with. And this is still a center-right country. I believe if the American people are educated and mobilized and awakened to what the stakes are, I believe there is a majority to cement outcomes that will lead to more judges who will give full force and effect to these constitutional guarantees.
Boy, if that isn't an excuse to make sure you go out and vote in 2020, I don't know what is. Ken Klukowski of First Liberty has been my fabulous guest today. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. God bless.
Thanks for joining us today on Washington Watch. For more information and for a podcast, go to TonyPerkins.com. You can follow Tony Perkins at T. Perry on Twitter. You can follow me at Sarah P. Perry as well on Twitter. Thanks so much for being with us today, and we will join you next week for another edition of Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.